This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
فإن بغداد مصممة شعبا وولاة أمر
على The people and rulers of Baghdad have resolved to compel the Mongols of this age to commit suicide on its walls and make the confrontation.
Saddam Hussein speaking through an interpreter in a speech on Friday, the 12th anniversary of the Gulf War, asking Iraqis to rise up and defend the country against the United States military, which he likened to the Mongol armies that sacked Baghdad in the year 1258. Dan Shore joined us now. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
And as we learned just before we went on the air, Key Maleski, our librarian, developed the information that, say what you will about Mongol hordes, they won in 1258.
Yes, and the word sacked went into our football history.
On Thursday, of course, you made a reference to football. That's why I'm just flabbergasted for a moment.
I'm amazed that you let it pass by you.
I didn't. Well, no longer. Of course, the UN's weapon inspectors unearthed several empty chemical weapon shells, suggesting that Saddam Hussein still has a program of developing weapons of mass destruction. Now, this was not the oft-mentioned smoking gun, but according to the inspectors, it was also clearly more than just a bunch of empty shells. What does it say about the progress of inspections?
Well, the inspections are proceeding with what you call deliberate speed. The Bush administration would like a little more speed, a little less deliberate. The White House is making a big deal of those 11 empty chemical warheads. It says very serious, part of a pattern. The inspector, Chief Inspector Hans Blix, says, not so important. It looks as though this is all part of the United States saying that on January 27th, when they submit the next report, enough already with inspections, let's go on to the next thing, presumably war. But the United States is virtually alone in its desire to end the inspections and go on to the next thing. Everybody else says, let's allow more time for inspection. Still looking for that elusive smoking gun that you mentioned, which would make things easier for everybody if they found it, or hoping that something else will happen, like Saddam Hussein stepping down or being ousted in some real coup, some phony coup or whatever. It is not a very clear day at the moment.
Correct. There is the January 27th deadline that you mentioned. The United States organized a coalition to get a vote out of the Security Council to open Iraq up to the inspectors.
Correct.
What sort of progress is the administration making in getting, a similar coalition that would be necessary to fix a date, January 27th or thereafter, to begin some action, if that's what it comes to?
Well, a big problem there. Turkey has called a regional meeting to discuss how this thing can be done peacefully. The U.S. has only qualified support from the neighbors of Iraq that it would need to provide a launching platform for invasion, that is Turkey and Saudi Arabia, putting great limits on the kind of cooperation that they would offer. If this is to be a coalition of the willing, as President Bush calls it, it's not going to be a very big coalition. So I suspect they're going to have to reconsider their position before they say, okay, now let's go.
We will note that we've got demonstrations taking place today in Tokyo, Heidelberg, Christchurch, New Zealand, San Francisco, and, of course, in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, Ron Kovich, the author of Born on the 4th of July, calls this an extraordinary turning point in American history. It certainly is true that it is probably the biggest and best organized demonstration in Washington, San Francisco, and elsewhere across the country since the Vietnam War. But it's also very interesting that this is the first big popular protest movement organized in the Internet age. Mm-hmm. And the Internet apparently plays a very important part in the mobilization effort.
I want to turn now to North Korea, which obviously continued the diplomatic fallout with the United States this week. The Bush administration has shifted tone and signals more than once in recent weeks
indeed.
On this issue. In your judgment, is there a strategy behind the diffusion of messages?
Well, if you start with axis of evil, a national strategy called preemption, and express loathing for Kim Jong-il, and then you find that this weird little country may actually have nuclear weapons or maybe the making of nuclear weapons, then you have to have a post-preemption policy, like talk to us. Maybe we can provide you with energy assistance if you play nice. Maybe some other goodies. Secretary of State Powell says in an interview today with the Süddeutsche Zeitung, German newspaper, that we have no unfriendly intention towards North Korea. This is a policy in a process of abrupt change.
Mm. And, of course, affirmative action. This week, the White House filed a brief in the affirmative action case that's going to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. On Wednesday, the president gave a strongly worded speech opposing affirmative action. But the legal document in the brief was not nearly as stringent. Does the Bush administration stand by the brief or the speech?
Well, that depends on which President Bush you're talking about. There is the one who speaks to his conservative base. That was the one that stood out there in front of the cameras with a strong statement of opposition to affirmative action. And then there is the one who, in the dark of night near midnight, submits a brief to the Supreme Court that says that the University of Michigan's way of achieving diversity is wrong, but diversity in itself is a good thing. He doesn't say in this brief that any consideration of race would necessarily be wrong if you're trying to achieve diversity. So he makes no argument for reversing the 1978 Baca decision that was supposed to provide a plus, race as a plus factor in admissions. Where does President Bush stand on affirmative action? Firmly on both sides of the fence. All for diversity. Not clear how you get that diversity.
The observation that there's sometimes, I beg your pardon, a disparity between White House policy statements in any administration and an actual White House policy is not new. I'm wondering how you read the disparity or the difference in this administration.
Well, what you have is a president who feels very bold in his actions now because of having won last November's election in such a convincing manner, and he feels now that he has a lot of prestige, which he can put into doing things as, for example, like medical malpractice. There was a bill submitted. It didn't get very far in the last Congress. Now president says he's willing to submit it. He thinks he can do very much better.
Maybe I should come up and explain. This would put a cap on jury awards in medical malpractice cases,
at $250,000, right? And there have been some multi-million dollar awards, which has inflicted great pain on doctors and even greater pain on insurance companies. And so if you want to do something for the an insurance company's bill of rights, if I can put it that way, since they're not doing very much on a patient's bill of rights, then the president comes out and says, yes, let's have that. The pain and suffering portions of malpractice suits should be limited to $250,000. His position is that high malpractice awards drive up and health costs. He made his statement on this, incidentally, in Pennsylvania, which happens to be one of 13 states that, in fact, caps prohibits capping a malpractice award. And so now the only thing that's one of those who is not going to like this very much is, guess who? Senator John Edwards, candidate for president on the Democratic side,
from North
Carolina,
became
a multi-millionaire from all these malpractice awards.
And trial attorneys have been supporting the Democratic Party, according to campaign documents in recent years.
That's correct. But the doctors and insurance companies are also important parts of this campaign, and they weigh in.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan Schor.